Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The world is mourning the death of Nelson Mandela. The anti-apartheid leader was jailed for 27 years for his activism. Released in 1990, he became South Africa's first post-apartheid president in 1994. We did a show about Mandela's life and legacy on July 1st, and you can find that at yourcallradio.org. Today, we'll get reaction from our guests about Mandela's death and how his legacy is being covered in the media. We'll also discuss media coverage of the British government's decision to bring Guardian editor Alan Rusbridger before the House of Commons to discuss the decision behind publishing top secret information revealing mass surveillance by the U.S. and the U.K. Robert Mahoney, deputy director of the Committee to Protect Journalists, writes, quote, "The questioning, particularly from members of Cameron's Conservative Party, was intimidating and laced with innuendo that the paper had harmed national security and, in the opinion of one MP, even broke the law. The intimidation of journalists and news organizations covering the fallout from the Edward Snowden files is troubling for many reasons, not least because of the signal it sends to authoritarian and repressive regimes around the world," end quote. Joining us to discuss coverage of this is Josh Stearns, journalism and public media campaign director for Free Press, a nonprofit working to reform the media. He's co-author of Saving the News, Toward a National Journalism Strategy. Hi, Josh. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Rose.
Nice to have you. And we're joined by Kevin Gostola, journalist for Fire Dog Lakes, the Dissenter blog. He's co-author of the book Truth and Consequences, the U.S. versus Private Manning. Hi, Kevin. Welcome back.
Hey.
And we're also discussing media coverage of Syria. A UN fact-finding team has found massive evidence that the highest levels of the Syrian government are responsible for war crimes. But will anyone act on this, and what does act even mean in this context? Syria is not getting as much attention as it was getting a few months ago, as soon as President Obama announced that the U.S. would not intervene or bomb Syria. It fell off the radar, especially here in the U.S. And joining us to talk about coverage is Liz Sly. She's the Washington Post's Beirut bureau chief. For the past two decades, she's been a foreign correspondent in the Middle East, Africa, China, South Asia, and Europe. And she actually covered the election of Nelson Mandela. Hi, Liz. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you.
Thank you. Nice to have you. As we always do on Friday, we like to start off and give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. So, Josh, why don't we start off with you? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, just yesterday, I was reading through a Rolling Stone piece by Janet Reitman called Snowden and Greenwald, The Men Who Leaked the Secrets. And it was a really fascinating look, more of a biography of the two men, but it placed it within the context of the issues that you opened the show with in terms of the events happening in the UK around the Guardian newspaper and the press freedom issues all over the world. And I think it does a really good job of placing this question of how is information flowing and what is the important role of leaks now today in helping us understand our own government, and how does that impact press freedom and journalism? So I really enjoyed that piece.
And so what's the answer? Because this is getting so much attention in light of Alan Rusbridger answering questions from in the UK.
Well, I think one of the answers that's becoming increasingly clear is that as government secrecy continues to expand, things like the leaks that Edward Snowden brought to light are going to continue to happen and are actually going to continue to be an important part, sort of a pressure release system, when so much government secrecy is keeping so much from the public. If we really are going to believe in the fundamental force of democracy as an informed public, that information is going to have to come from somewhere.
Mm. Well, and we'll talk more about this a little later in the show, because there's been outrage from a number of media outlets, the New York Times, the Associated Press, the American Society of News Editors. So we'll talk about how the media are also reacting to this. So kudos to the Rolling Stone for this story by Janet Whiteman, and we'll put a link on our website right after the show. What about you, Kevin? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I have to go along the same lines as Josh here and cite the work of Barton Gellman and Ashkan Sultani at Washington Post. This may not be a story that has flown under the radar, but it dealt with the ability of the NSA to track cell phone locations worldwide. I think it's relevant to what we're going to be discussing in this program. But mostly, one thing that stood out to me about this report that I really appreciate is that there's a level of skepticism that goes throughout this article as you're getting the views of officials who are giving statements. And I think that's remarkable because it tends to be that when officials have said something, it's taken to be truth. Whereas in this case, to give one example, it was found that tens of millions of Americans who travel abroad are having their cell phones, their location data is being intercepted by the NSA. And that's according to the NSA all incidentally. But what I like about this story is that they give a definition of incidentally in this article that suggests that it isn't that, you know, basically they do a hedging, they do a parsing of words. It's not that it's going to be deliberate, but they do know that it's a foreseeable result that they will be collecting this data. And so I praise Barton and I praise Soltani for the way that they presented the story.
All right. And we'll talk about details of that also, because it seems like new information just continues to roll out. And I'd love to find out how you both keep up with this and how you decide where to place your attention when it comes to reporting. And what about you, Liz? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I'd like to draw attention to the Washington Post obituary for Nelson Mandela today. And I have a very personal reason for doing that, as you said. I covered the election in 1994. I was based there for several years. And one of my dear colleagues there, who was also, I think, the finest journalist to ever cover South Africa, was Lynn Duke, who was the Washington Post correspondent at the time. Now, she died in May of cancer, and I was really struck this morning when I opened up the website and found that whatever obituary that she would have started to have written back in the 90s when she was the correspondent. As you know, in journalism, we keep on file obituaries of the key top leaders, and the correspondent has to is responsible for doing that. So the obituary that would have been written back then was revived and updated, of course. But it's Lynn's work. It's Lynn's writing. Mm. You can see her personality. You can see her insights in it. And it's kind of a tiny little sad footnote to that whole era that Mandela, with all his vigor and love for life and longevity, actually outlived this young woman who died too soon.
What made her such a great reporter?
Well, Lynn was, first of all, a very fantastic writer. She was an extremely fluent writer. You can see that in everything she wrote. She also wrote a book called Mandela and Me, which was about her experiences of Africa. She was an African-American. She embraced the nature of the story in a very personal way. I think it's very important for journalists, if they're going to convey what they're writing about to other people, they have to care about what they're writing and put some of themselves into it so that the people who read about it also care about what they're reading about. And Lynn was able to do that and bring that to the Africa story.
Well, and I'd love to open the lines, because this is getting so much attention, if you'd like to talk about coverage of Mandela's death. What are your thoughts on it? If you've seen some stories since the news broke that resonated with you or maybe taught you something new, we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. What really strikes you about the coverage that you've read and heard yesterday and then also this morning? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. And we did a show about Mandela's legacy on July 1st when he first got sick. And some of our guests said that they were concerned that the media might sanitize his legacy like they've done with Martin Luther King, for example. What are your thoughts on that, Liz, just based on what you've read and seen so far?
Well, I don't know. As somebody who was there and saw this thing happen, and I also say I can't help but draw a huge contrast with covering Syria right now. I can't take anything away from Mandela. The what he achieved, the role of his personality in achieving that at that time was extraordinary. And now we've seen all these uprisings for democracy and freedom in the Middle East, and people thought maybe the Middle East was finally going to have its South African moment, but it hasn't gone like that. And one of the reasons it hasn't is because of the lack of leaders of wisdom and vision. And so I am not somebody who can take away from Mandela, I'm sorry. And maybe that is fantasizing his legacy, but I did see how dangerous it was in those years and what could have gone wrong, and I'm seeing what can go wrong now as well. And I think you have to hand it to him.
And you're based in Beirut. How is this being covered in the Middle East?
Well, it's very different covering things in the Middle East to how it was in South Africa. I mean, you have a particular problem with the Syria story because it's very hard to go to Syria at the moment. And it's become very dangerous because they're kidnapping a lot of journalists. There's about nearly two dozen of our colleagues who are missing there. And so actually not being there makes it very hard to cover, and that makes it very different from the South African story as well. But obviously there are other parts of the Middle East you can go to. You can cover up close what's happening in Egypt. And that's unfolding in a very different way from South Africa as well.
And Josh, what really strikes you about the coverage? Any observations you'd like to share?
Well, one of the pieces that I've really been struck by is the visual nature of the memorials that have been propping up on the internet. There are so many stunning and powerful pictures of Mandela that show how he crossed barriers, that show how he brought people together, and that capture the energy and passion that he so embodied in his own activism. And so I think there's a way in which now the web allows for so much sort of visual memorializing as well as textual memorializing. And so the obituaries, you know, in the New York Times, the Washington Post, and other places have been very powerful, but so too have all of the floods of pictures that have been pouring over social media and the quotes and, you know, even hearing audio on NPR. And so we live the remembrance of these people in a multimedia way now that's really bringing them back to life at the moment of their death in really profound ways.
Hmm. What about you, Kevin? What strikes you?
Well, to speak to people who are worried about sanitizing the legacy, I take your question to be not necessarily, you know, are there bad things about Mandela that we need to be talking about instead of deifying and making him out to be a saint, but maybe are there things about his legacy that we're incorrectly representing? And I think one thing that might be lost as I look at some of the coverage, particularly on CNN, maybe even on MSNBC, is this idea of reconciliation, of how he brought people together early 1990s. But from my knowledge, from reading like his book, Long Walk to Freedom, and from looking at some other aspects of the history of South Africa, it would appear that it was not possible for reconciliation until the struggle against apartheid had actually gained the power to have this moment. And that might be something that's sort of lost, is all of the sacrifice that had to be gone through in order to get to that moment. There seems to be a lot of focus on the end result of that period of his release, early 90s, and then being elected president. And that's very momentous, I think. But there's a very horrid and sordid kind of history previously that could come out as well in the coverage.
That's interesting, because when we did our show, we talked about the horrible conditions he lived in prison, the fact that he was forgotten for so long. And when he came to the United States to speak, I mean, you know, they had to raise money to get him on a bus. Just really interesting backstories that you don't hear much about. Liz, what are your thoughts on Kevin's opinion about, you know, what happened in between time, not just the end?
Well, yes, there was a long struggle against apartheid in the years up to his release, indeed. And one thing that was slightly bubbling under the surface at the time is the fact that it wasn't really Mandela so much who was accused in this regard, but a lot of the top leaders had been in. The original top leaders either went into exile or they went into prison. And Mandela went into prison and a bunch of them went into exile. And they came back at this time and started taking over the ANC and ended up with a lot of the top jobs in the ANC. And there was a lot of resentment from the people on the ground who'd done the hard slog of leading the fight against apartheid. who got eclipsed at this time. And there was some slight, like, inkling of resentment even about the guys who'd been sitting in prison a little bit, that they hadn't been doing hard work, but nobody ever blamed Mandela in this regard. But yes, in those years, there was a struggle. There was violence. There was violence on all sides. There was violence between the black communities, black on white violence, white on black violence. You name it. A lot of people died in that fight. Yes, and the ugliest time was the period between his release and the election in '94. That's when it looked like it was going to go pear-shaped. That's when you could have had serious civil war in the country. And somehow he managed to pull it back from the brink in those years.
And Rose, I would add that, you know, the sanitization that people worry about, I think, not so much about Mandela, but I also worry about the sanitization of the historical wrongs that were also done against him. It's easy to see him now as a hero, but it's important to remember that even here in the U.S., especially here in the U.S., he wasn't always seen that way. You know,
right.
I saw reporting about the fact that he was not taken off of the terror watch list until 2008
right.
here in the U.S. And so we shouldn't also sanitize the fact that the struggles that he faced were not just in South Africa, but worldwide, and even our own country treated him pretty poorly at times.
Yeah, actually, NPR had a good conversation this morning about, you know, like Ronald Reagan vetoed a bill to impose sanctions on South Africa and other things that happened here in the United States that's really important for historical context. Today, we're joined by Josh Stearns. He's public media campaign director for Free Press. Kevin Gostola is a journalist with Fire Dog Lakes, the Dissenter blog. And Liz Sly is the Washington Post Beirut Bureau Chief. She covered the election of Nelson Mandela in 1994. And after we take a few calls, we'll speak with Liz about coverage of Syria. But first, let's take a few calls on Nelson Mandela. Let's hear from Max in Berkeley. Hi, Max. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you for a good program. I'll mention something very briefly. Today, I just read an article that appeared in the UK Guardian about Mandela's wife. And they quote her, "I learned to separate the man from the myth. It's a moving story, a beautiful story. It's wonderful that the man found happiness towards the end of his life in partnership with such a formidable woman in her own right." I'll stop here and thank you for taking my call.
Okay, well, thank you, Max. It sounds like a nice story, and I'll read it for sure after the show, but we'll also put a link on our website. Thank you. Let's hear next from Harry in San Francisco. Hi, Harry.
Hi, yes, good morning. First of all, I wanted to comment that I think it's disgusting that a lot of African leaders, many of whom should be in jail for war crimes, are going to jump up and down about Nelson Mandela. And also, I was wondering to what extent Nelson Mandela bears a responsibility for the disaster that the ANC has become with these top leaders, Jacob Zuma making a joke out of himself and Zuma. Becky also, really horrible record in the ANC. The only opposition to the ANC is this guy, Julius Malema, who's, I think he's in jail now, actually, and he's rather pathetic also. And it seems as though the ANC is something out of Animal Farm. They've all gone and enriched themselves, whereas the average, an unemployment rate is still huge in South Africa. There's all these problems, and the whole thing about pretending how the AIDS crisis didn't exist and adopting the philosophy from this guy from UC Berkeley with something else. So I was wondering, to what extent does Mandela's legacy need to be judged in terms of what happened afterwards, and to what extent is that not his fault at all?
All right. Well, thank you. Liz, what are your thoughts on that?
I could barely hear, but he was talking about the ANC's legacy of violence. Is that right?
Right. And just talking about how a lot of these corrupt leaders are now standing up, talking about what a great man Mandela was and celebrating his legacy.
I think I heard something about that the ANC did some very bad things, yes, and that is certainly true. I don't think you can take away from the fact that there was an awful lot of violence committed in the name of the ANC, especially in those last months in the run-up to the election, when the ANC and Inkatha were competing on the ground for votes and for support, and that there were maybe 30,000 people killed in that year. Stabbings, a lot of them shootings. It was very, very unpleasant. And, you know, some people would say Mandela was involved in that. I see him as having pulled everybody back from that, and that's where his genius and magic lay. In terms of corrupt leaders in the world, praising him now as a great leader, I think it is really quite amusing to see that. Yes, and the number of people in the Middle East who have stood up to claim his legacy, praise him, and these are people who, you know, would be killing each other if they possibly had the chance. So I have found that quite amusing, actually. Mm.
And last question, Liz, since you did cover the election of Nelson Mandela, what are your thoughts about coverage of South Africa at a time when it remains divided by racial separation, deep, deep inequality, education and health sectors are inadequate at best? How are your colleagues covering these issues? And if you were still there, what story would you be writing?
Well, that probably is the story. I have to say I don't always read all of the South Africa coverage. I check in every now and then. I visited again a couple of years ago. It is quite striking how very little has changed and kind of disappointing about how very little has changed. But then on the other hand, so much has changed. I mean, here you're talking about a country that's an African country, a conservative country, a country with a history of violence and a deep divide, that has one of the most liberal constitutions in the world and some of the most liberal outlooks and attitudes to life in the world. And it's just seen, it's got a pretty transparent constitution, transparent elections and legislature. It's corrupt, but it's not become what the other African countries were and how they have gone down the tubes and ruined their own chances of ever having, ever being like, shining examples of good countries, or at least for the time being. So I still have hope for South Africa. I still think it can get there. But the legacy of that inequality is so huge. I don't really know how you ever overcome it. Mm.
And that is Liz Sly. She is the Washington Post's Beirut bureau chief. She covered the election of Nelson Mandela in 1994, and now she's covering what is happening on the ground in Syria. She was last there in April. She hasn't been able to go back because the government gives out very few visas. It's also much too dangerous. 30 journalists have been kidnapped in northern Syria. And Liz, Syria sort of fell off the front pages in the United States as soon as President Obama announced that the U.S. wouldn't bomb the country. What is it like for you working for The Washington Post from there? I mean, what is the story in Syria right now? And do you agree that it's not getting as much attention?
Oh, yes, it's definitely not getting as much as attention was. As this civil war accelerated throughout most of the past year, we had a situation where this was a war that could definitely suck in America. Obama had drawn a red line. It looked like the Americans would intervene if the red line was crossed. The red line was crossed. It looked like the Americans were going to intervene, and then said, no, we won't intervene. So it became a war in which America was not going to get involved. So suddenly it's just one of the other wars that's going on in the world. Definitely we've seen a sharp drop-off in interest since that time. I have to say the Washington Post remains very interested. There isn't any lack of appetite for serious stories. But the amount of front page attention that it's getting, the amount of attention that the smaller developments are getting, definitely has fallen off across the board. You can see that.
And we're going to take a quick break. If you would like to talk about coverage of Syria or have questions about what's happening now, since it's not getting as much attention, the refugee crisis is getting attention because reporters are able to interview people outside of Syria. But we'll talk about that right after the break. And then later in the show, we will discuss coverage of the British government's decision to bring Guardian editor Alan Rusbridger before the House of Commons to talk about the decision behind publishing top secret information leaked by Edward Snowden. What does this mean for press freedoms around the globe? You can give us a call. You can also email us. And if you have another story that you saw this week that deserves more attention, we'd love to hear about it. It's your call. We'll be back after this.
Recommended on the Friday Media Roundtable will be posted on our website, yourcallradio.org. We also invite you to highlight the reporting you thought was valuable this week by joining us on the phone. It's 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK, or if you'd rather write, send your email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11 o'clock, special presentation from the BBC's World Have Your Say, a remembrance of Nelson Mandela.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. On Monday, we will continue our conversation about the rollout of the Affordable Care Act and what it means for you. And this time, we'll be focusing on Medi-Cal. As California's program prepares for a major expansion, a lot of doctors say that they cannot accept new patients because the program does not pay enough. So how will the state serve the additional 2 million people expected to join the program? And then on Tuesday, we'll talk about low-wage workers organizing. On Friday, last Friday, Walmart workers went on strike and protested and had actions in front of almost 1,500 stores across the country. And then yesterday, fast food workers walked off the job in 100 cities. So we'll talk about how they are organizing on Tuesday's show. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line. feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today it is our media roundtable, the day we speak with reporters about coverage of the week's news, and we are joined by Josh Stearns, Journalism and Public Media Campaign Director for Free Press. Kevin Gostola is a journalist with Fire Dog Lakes, the Dissenter blog, and we'll be speaking with them in just a couple minutes about continuing coverage of the NSA leaks. And Liz Sly is the Washington Post's Beirut Bureau Chief. She's been covering what's happening in Syria, although she cannot get inside the country because it's too dangerous and the government gives very few visas. So, Liz, at this time, what is the story inside Syria? And because you cannot go there, you have to rely on Skype and social media and things like that. But what are you hearing from people inside Syria?
Well, basically, the story there is the continuing intense violence. You're still having between 100 and 200 people dying every day, which makes this the bloodiest war we've seen in the world for a very long time. There are airstrikes every day. There are battles every day in which soldiers are dying. But I think from the point of view of a lot of the ordinary people in Syria, the story for them is the relentless airstrikes, the relentless shelling, the sheer struggle to stay alive as well when very few supplies are around, the economy's collapsed, and access to food is very difficult, and the winter's coming. So, to me, the story is really how horrible life is there, and it's so frustrating to not be able to go there and write about that.
And what about all of the major players involved in this? I mean, your latest piece for The Washington Post is about a Hezbollah commander who was assassinated outside of his home in Beirut. How are you getting information about who's actually involved, who's funneling money, who's calling the shots here?
Well, yes, we're seeing in Syria at the moment, we're seeing a revival of a very old conflict that's been on or off for most of the past three decades, which has been a kind of proxy war, if you like, between Iran on the one hand, the West on the other hand, Israel to a certain extent, and the Sunni states led by Saudi Arabia. And all of these powers have piled into Syria with money, support, sponsorship of the different factions. And what we're seeing now in Syria is all those parties fighting for supremacy in Syria, which is in the middle of all of them, and all of them want to control it. So you've got Iran versus Saudi Arabia, and to a lesser extent, Israel in the West as well.
Now, what about the United States?
Well, yes, the West has lined up behind the opposition, with the United States sort of leading from behind on that, but they're not even in the lead of it. So they're not really out in front of this at all, but they're there, of course. And they've said they'll give some support to the opposition and some arms to the rebels. And they've given a very small amount, very, very tiny, begrudging amount, very late because of the rising influence of the jihadis and the extremists, who they don't want to see getting these weapons in their hands. So the Americans are really behind the lines on this, but they're there, without a doubt, in pushing the opposition to debate and have a political settlement with the regime at the negotiations that are going to take place in Geneva, which is going to be the next phase of this story. But I think the situation on the ground is so dismal at the moment that the peace conference that we're expecting this next month is not going to produce any results for a long time.
And a UN fact-finding team has found, quote, massive evidence that the highest levels of the Syrian government are responsible for war crimes. Is this significant?
It's interesting that they found that, but I'm not sure it really means very much at this point. I don't think anybody's really in dispute that, first of all, the government there has done some pretty atrocious things in its efforts to crush this uprising, which began as a peaceful uprising demanding democratic reforms. They've used every sort of weapon at their disposal to put this down, ending up with the chemical weapons that we saw in August. So it's really come as a surprise that they found that. Perhaps it's politically significant that they've stated it, but the bigger question is, what are they going to do about it? Is anybody going to arrest him? Is anybody going to send troops to stop this fighting? We kind of know from what happened with the chemical weapons in August that that isn't going to happen. So at the moment, it's just falls into the category of more people saying things that won't make any difference.
Well, Rose, your mention of the UN is an interesting point, because one of the interesting trends in the coverage of Syria is the role that non-traditional journalism players have played, whether you call those citizen journalists or non-traditional journalists. And a couple weeks ago in the New York Times, there was a piece called "In Syria, Advocates Step In to Sift for the Truth," about the role that human rights organizations are increasingly playing to help sort fact from fiction, getting that ground truth data and evidence and getting it back out into the hands of journalists. As well as, even like the New Republic did a whole piece on a guide to Syria's best citizen journalism. Hmm. So we see this new cadre of people who are trying to play a journalistic role, who are trying to be participants in telling the story and getting the word out about their country, because it is so dangerous and is so hard for journalists to get in there. And that's a really important trend I think we should watch, because those people need protections the same way that our journalists do as well.
Right. Yeah. Are you, Liz, I know you're in touch with people inside Syria, but are you in touch with some of these citizen journalists?
Well, yes, totally. I mean, we rely on them a lot. You hear about something happening somewhere, you get in touch with these people. You get in touch with them to ask them if it's true, to ask them what they saw. They're posting things constantly on websites, on YouTube, and it's basically how we learn what's going on. And it really is a blessing. This would be a black hole, and I think that's one of the things that's that came pretty early on as a bit of a kind of shock to the government, which kept journalists out. And I think that it thought that if it kept journalists out, it could do what it wanted there, crush the rebellion. It would be where nobody would really know, which is exactly what happened in 1982 when President Assad's father crushed a similar rebellion. And in this one, even though journalists can't actually go there, you do see a lot of, if you turn on CNN International, the international version, or Al Jazeera, you will see a lot of footage from Syria, a lot of imagery of the bombs, the people, the suffering, and that's being taken by citizen journalists from inside Syria.
And Liz, what are you working on right now?
I'm looking at a kind of big, complicated thing involving borders and history that's what I'm working on.
All right. Well, Liz, thank you so much for staying up and joining us today.
Thank you.
That is Liz Sly. She is the Washington Post's Beirut bureau chief. She's covering Syria, but she has to cover it from Beirut because she cannot get a visa. It's also too dangerous to go to Syria. She's reported from Africa, China, South Asia, and Europe and the Middle East for the past two decades. And you can find her work at yourcallradio.org. And now we're going to talk about the continuing NSA leaks and the British government's decision to bring Guardian editor Alan Rusbridger before the House of Commons to discuss the decision behind publishing top secret information revealed by Edward Snowden. This is getting a lot of attention. In one Guardian story, They point out that this is actually getting more attention outside of the UK than inside. The Washington Post has done extensive coverage, the New York Times in Australia, France, India, and Japan. And we're talking about this with Josh Stearns, journalism and public media campaign director for Free Press, and Kevin Gostola, a journalist for Fire Dog Lakes, the Dissenter blog. So it's really interesting because when you looked at how Alan Rusbridger answered these questions, he said, for example, the Guardian, quote, would not be put off by intimidation, but nor are we going to behave recklessly. He said that the Guardian had consulted government officials and intelligence agencies, including the FBI, the White House, and the Cabinet Office, on more than 100 occasions before they decided to publish the stories. Kevin, what did this hearing, what really struck you about this hearing?
Well, the first thing we should get to is that from my research, it would seem that there were zero TV news segments that were done on this year in the United States. That would include NBC, ABC News, PBS, MSNBC, CNN, the Fox News Network, that even though they brought this editor-in-chief before this parliamentary committee and there was video available for broadcast, that no one made use of this scene, which at times, at least in the opening especially, resembled a House Un-American Activities Committee hearing. We had Keith Vaz actually ask Alan Rusbridger the question, do you love this country? And I think he was taken aback and wasn't quite sure how to answer that.
Hmm. And that was a who asked this question?
Keith Vaz, who was the chair of this House committee. It was the House Common Affairs Committee.
And according to the Committee to Protect Journalists, at least three MPs asked him if he broke the law.
Yeah, that's correct. And I think, you know, and Josh can get into more detail. I'm sure he wants to talk about this as well. But the one thing I want to highlight is, and this is going into more detail on what was discussed in this hearing, is that a lot of these people accusing Rusbridger and The Guardian of violating the law were not targeting publication. They weren't targeting their right to publish this material in their newspaper. They were targeting a transmission or communication of these files to the New York Times abroad, and accusing them of risking putting these the UK spy agency is GCHQ, putting these agents' names at risk because they were in these files that were then mailed or sent over to the New York Times so that they could partner with The Guardian. And this sort of what we see happening here in this hearing is very problematic for the future of journalism, because right now we have globalized journalism. We have people working cross-country with one another. You have Glenn Greenwald partnering with La Espresso in Italy to publish stories on the NSA files. You have Glenn Greenwald partnering with people in Sweden to do coverage of files, and partnering with CBC in Canada to do cover the files. But if you can target communication and if you can criminalize that aspect, it makes media partnership much more difficult.
I want to stay on this point for a second. I think it's an important one, because what happened here is that the UK government began putting so much pressure on The Guardian by coming into their Guardian headquarters and actually destroying hard drives and threatening them with prosecution, that The Guardian decided that it would be strategic and important to continue this reporting from its U.S. offices and do so in partnership with other news organizations to make sure the reporting could continue, because this is information that's so much in the public interest. And so you have a situation where the U.K. government is basically forcing the hand of the news organization, and in the meantime, other news organizations in the U.K. have been downplaying this entire issue, have not been reporting on it, or have been treating it as though it's not a real story. And so you have a situation where there's no one internally in the UK who's going to partner with them. And in fact, the UK government is making sure of that. But then when they go to partner with a news organization abroad, you get this, you know, argument that you're transmitting sensitive information. So to Kevin's point, I think, you know, when we begin arguing that the transmission of this information between journalists, and this is really the argument of, you know, David Miranda, who is Glenn Greenwald's partner and was being paid by The Guardian to travel, to fly on planes between journalists to get them the documents they needed to do their work. When he was detained under terrorism charges, that was the argument, is he's you know, going across borders with sensitive data. this is purely a journalistic activity. It's one that's being forced upon us because we can't pick up the phone, because we can't email anymore, because it's all being watched.
So the Guardian has written extensively about press freedoms. What are your thoughts on how other outlets, specifically in the U.S., are dealing with these issues? Because Rez Bridger said that The Guardian had been put under the kind of pressure to stop publishing stories that would have been inconceivable in other countries. And then you've got organizations like The New York Times and the AP writing a letter to the committee in the UK urging it to use the occasion of his appearance to reaffirm Britain's commitment to a vigorous, free and independent press. The letter also expresses, quote, grave concern over pointed calls by those in authority for censorship and criminal prosecution of its journalists in the name of national security, end quote. So, Josh, what are you seeing in the U.S. about this important issue of press freedoms?
Well, I've been writing a couple pieces now that are documenting the rise of what I've been calling journalist solidarity. And I think we've always had a tradition where the industry of journalism has stood up for its own best interests. And that oftentimes aligns with the public's interest, you know, in terms of fighting for the Freedom of Information Act and other important protections. But what we're seeing now is a different kind of solidarity that really is getting down to both journalists and journalists working with individual journalists, but then also these news organizations not only looking out for their interests domestically, but also fighting for press freedom and freedom of expression abroad. And so we saw these news organizations writing to the UK, but we've also seen news organizations working together to push back on the Obama administration in really fundamental and important ways, whether it be the fact that the Obama administration has sort of cut off photographers' access to the White House and are just distributing their own official photographic press releases, you might call them, or the whole range of ways that the Obama administration is clamping down on leakers and threatening journalists with prosecution, looking at their phone and email records. In the last 6 months, between the NSA revelations and the things that have gone on at the Department of Justice through the AP and Fox News investigations that were happening there, we have seen, I think, a real turning point in American press freedom where we, for too long, assumed we've got the First Amendment, it's all good, we'll be fine. And now we're realizing that if we believe that press freedom is fundamental to an informed public and a democracy, we need to fight for it.
That is Josh Stearns, Journalism and Public Media Campaign Director for Free Press, a nonprofit working to reform the media. He's co-author of Saving the News Toward a National Journalism Strategy. Kevin Gostola writes for Fire Dog Lakes, the Dissenter blog. He's co-author of the book Truth and Consequences, the U.S. versus Private Manning. And if you'd like to join us to talk about coverage of the NSA and the questioning of Guardian editor Alan Rez Bridger, what really strikes you about coverage of these leaks? It just seems like there's new information coming out on a regular basis. And if you have a story that you saw this week that you think deserves more attention, we'd love to hear about that. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from George in San Francisco. Hi, George. Welcome to the show.
Hey, not more than 24 hours ago, there was a very useful interview on Fresh Air. You might want to add to your list of this week's news stories that bear attention, which was on the question, why do people confess to crimes they did not commit? And it was an interview with Douglas Starr, who has an article in The New Yorker for December 9th, titled, I think, something like, Do Police Interrogation Techniques Produce False Confessions? Douglas Starr. And that, we're fond of saying nothing happens in a vacuum. Well, that must be somehow or other connected with the understanding now that we have that we're all under surveillance 24/7. And if that's what our intelligence operatives are doing, spying on everyone 24/7, then we have to ask, does that mean they don't know who's the enemy? It's not exactly what we hired them to find out, that nobody can be trusted, right? So that's how fundamental it is, and I thank you for your continuing to remind us of these postings.
All right, well, thank you for that, and we'll put a link to the Terry Gross interview on our show right after we're done. And, you know, the other thing that I find interesting about this is all these nuggets of information, Kevin and Josh, that come out from these questions. And so, for example, Guardian editor Alan Rusbridger told the committee in the UK that the Guardian published only 1% of the more than 50,000 Snowden files. And see, he said, despite bullying, he'd continue to write stories critical of government spying. So, Kevin, I mean, this is 1% of 50,000 files. You have to wonder, what else do they have? And how are they going to continue rolling this out?
It is, but that 1% has really gone a long way. I think that we have to keep in mind that Glenn Greenwald, who was one of the people that Edward Snowden came to, and as he was a freelancer for The Guardian at the time, and then Laura Poitras, they're the two journalists that have the full sets of files. The Guardian has a fraction of that, and they said they've published 1% of the material they were given. So it's actually less than 1% has been published. Wow. And we know going forward that there's going to be a new media project taking off next year. And in the meantime, we've got Greenwald and Poitras and other journalists partnering with our organizations all around the world, continuing to publish. You had the Huffington Post story around porn spying. And so it continues to be critical. I actually, you know, there's been some argument over whether the slow pace is a good thing or not, that we've only gotten through less than 1% of the material. And I think that it's actually very valuable that this pace has been very slow.
Did you say porn spying?
Yeah. You're not aware of the story?
I think I've heard about it, but no, I haven't read about it. What is it?
Okay, so there, quickly, 30 seconds, because, you know, limited time here. There are people who have been labeled radicalizers. That's the term, radicalizers, who happen to be radical Muslims who have dangerous views against the United States, who have, these views range from things like non-Muslims should be considered occupiers and we need to get them out of our country, to we believe the U.S. was behind 9/11, to we think that any U.S. forces that occupy our country should be fought with, met with violence or whatever. These are views. There's no evidence that any of these people who were targeted initially were involved in terrorism, and what they did was they planned to discredit them by exposing that these thinkers, most of them are thinkers, they're like clerics, they are known for being able to influence populations and countries, and six people, one of them a U.S. person, was targeted. They wanted to discredit, if possible, this person by showing that they had looked at pornography.
Huh. And who came up with this idea?
It was the NSA director, Keith Alexander's office.
And did they actually go through with it, or was it just an idea?
You know, that's unknown. We don't actually know if they went through with it. I think that if I presume they did go through, but I'm not quite sure if any of these people actually were ever discredited.
Wow. Well, and so the other thing here is a lot of the attention is focusing on, you know, the grilling of these reporters, a lot of infighting back and forth. But what about the details? It seems like a lot of media outlets are running stories about the details of what the NSA is actually doing. And it's really hard for journalists to keep up, let alone, you know, the average person who reads the news. So, Kevin, can you also give us a quick overview of the report that came out in The Washington Post about the NSA tracking billions of cell phone calls daily?
The quick overview would just be that they're playing with words. It's they say that they're incidentally collecting all of this information. They've directed the ability to collect to any sort of apparatus, to the cell towers, to centers, wherever they're collecting the information from the cables. It's all being directed outside the United States, because any data that moves through any of the networks outside the United States is not covered by the Fourth Amendment. And so they are going that direction, and they know that in their collection, they're going to be getting U.S. persons' data, the data of U.S. citizens that are traveling abroad, or people who are abroad, or maybe they're even collecting domestic communications that's going through the networks abroad. They're collecting this data, and they are hedging around the fact that what they're doing is actually unlawful and unauthorized, and trying to claim that there's really nothing they can do, and plus, they're not targeting Americans. I want to make one quick point if I have a moment.
Sure.
I know Josh wants to get back in here before we wrap the show here, but something that needs to come out and we need to be clear is that there are people who are involved in reporting this story who can't travel right now. They have decided that if they want to come back to the United States, they would probably be detained or harassed, and they would have their work disrupted. That includes Laura Poitras, Glenn Greenwald, Jacob Applebaum, Sarah Harrison, who works for WikiLeaks and helped Snowden when he was in Hong Kong and in Moscow. These people are isolated, and I don't think that people here in the United States who are especially establishment media journalists, they haven't taken this seriously, this idea that people can't come back to their own country.
Has this gotten much coverage?
Oh, yeah, the one place that actually has, I think, done a good job with this, although they're still making the larger connections, is On the Media, who has reported for 4 weeks in a row about the Department of Homeland Security and Border Patrol, because one of their own journalists was detained for a number of hours, something like 6 hours, at the Toronto border with Buffalo here in the U.S. And so they've actually been trying to get answers on some of these border security issues and have been doing some very good reporting on that. And we've actually been following this very closely, and we've just delivered 78,000 petition signatures to Eric Holder's office asking him to clarify press freedom issues and all people's right to avoid illegal search and seizure of their electronic devices at U.S. borders. Right now, the Department of Justice was forced by President Obama to revise all of their rules related to how they subpoena journalist information. Now we're asking for a similar revision and review of the rules that mandate how journalists can pass through the borders and how we can protect their press freedom rights when they pass through U.S. borders. Because someone like Laura Poitras has already been detained 40 times at U.S. borders.
40 times?
That's right.
Wow. And we're going to end just quickly, but Josh, what are you working on right now?
Well, you know, one of the things that we haven't touched on, a lot of what we've discussed today has been around mainstream major news organizations and press freedom issues, but all of these issues are trickling down and greatly impacting independent journalists at small nonprofit news organizations or independent bloggers and citizen journalists who are facing a range of other press freedom issues at the state and local level.
Yeah.
And so we actually just worked on a report related to that called Protecting All Acts of Journalism, and I'm developing strategies to help press freedom, no matter who you are as a journalist, large or small, we want to support you.
Wow, that sounds like a great story, and we'll definitely have some of those journalists on our future Friday shows. Kevin, we'll find out what you're working on, because I'm sure we'll have you on soon again. Kevin Gostola is journalist with Fire Dog Lake and author of the book Truth and Consequences. Josh Stearns is journalism and public media campaign director for Free Press, co-author of Saving the News. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you, and thanks for listening. Thanks for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. What do you want to know about Medi-Cal? On the next Your Call, we're continuing our conversation about the rollout of the Affordable Care Act and what it means for you. And this time, we're focusing on Medi-Cal. As California's program prepares for a major expansion, some doctors say they can't accept new patients because it doesn't pay enough. So how will the state serve the additional 2 million people expected to join the program? What do you want to know about Medi-Cal? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan, Ali Budner, and Becca Hoekstra produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.